Good evening. For those of you whom I haven't had the pleasure of meeting, my name is Paul LeClaire, and it's my privilege to be the president of the best of all possible libraries, the New York Public Library, and on behalf of our chairman, Katie Marin, and all of our trustees and staff, to welcome you to the Celeste Bartos Forum this evening for the third and final conversation about philanthropy that's taken place here over the last 2 and now 3 years. Made possible by the generous sponsorship of the Bank of New York Mellon. And through the special intervention of one of the library's best friends, Ed Gardner, and to recognize Susan Morgenthau, who is the co-chair of the library's Council of Conservators. If you haven't heard about the library's Council of Conservators, let me just take 10 seconds to tell you that it is one of the single most important support groups that we have at the library. Many of the members are here this afternoon, and if you are not now a conservator, it would please me and them very, very much if you considered joining this group. If you look at the history of libraries, and especially libraries open to the public for free, as this one is, you will share my sense that philanthropic engagement in libraries is one of the single most important things that we can do. But you'll also know that this is something that's gone back at least 2,000 years, because the first library ever created and opened to the public for free was done so in ancient Rome by Julius Caesar. The unattractive part of this is that he was assassinated before the library was completed. The attractive part is that he was the first great philanthropist, because it was his money. Don't ask me where the money came from. But he was the first great philanthropist to build a library, or to at least start building a library for the public. What philanthropists in New York have done over the last 100 years is to have invested very, very substantial amounts of money in toto, anywhere from very modest gifts of $25 to $40 up to mega gifts that have come to us from individuals, from foundations, and from corporations. And on the basis of those gifts, what we have done here in New York is truly remarkable. We have built the biggest, the best, and the most democratically accessible great library collection in human history in this building. So we would love you to be our partners. Our guests this evening have been our partners in this endeavor for many, many years. They're great, special, wonderful friends of mine and of the libraries. They are Judith Roden of the Rockefeller Foundation and Walter Isaacson of the Aspen Institute. They'll be having a conversation undirected by us before you, but before they begin, let me just tell you a few things about each one of them. Judith Roden has served as the president of the Rockefeller Foundation since 2005. The Rockefeller Foundation is, as I think we all know and appreciate, one of the oldest and largest private foundations in the world. And Dr. Roden will provide in her comments, I think, a unique view of private philanthropy, as she oversees a foundation with $3.8 billion in assets, founded with a mission to promote the well-being of people throughout the globe. Under her leadership, Rockefeller has reconsidered and reconceptualized and redirected its giving program in very, very important new ways. One of the great legacies of the Rockefeller Foundation is that it is the organization that really started and promoted and led to great success the Green Revolution in Africa, when people in that continent were starving because of low productivity of their agricultural programs. With the help of Rockefeller, in its advocacy and its direction, those nations began to revolutionize the way that they were growing crops, and they became self-sufficient in foodstuffs. Before coming to the Rockefeller Foundation, Dr. Roden was the president of the University of Pennsylvania, the first woman, in fact, to preside over an Ivy League university, something that's rather common these days, but she was the trailblazer. And that followed her tenure at Yale University as provost. While at Yale, she was a professor for 22 years, where she was the author of more than 200 academic articles and chapters in the area of behavioral medicine and health psychology, and has written or co-written 12 books, all of which I think we have here at the New York Public Library. As her teammate tonight, we have Walter Isaacson, who is the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, a nonpartisan, special word, much appreciated these days, a nonpartisan educational and policies institute. The mission of the Aspen Institute is twofold. First, to foster values-based leadership encouraging individuals to reflect on the ideals and ideas that define a good society, and second, to provide a neutral and balanced venue for discussing and acting on critical issues. Before joining the Aspen Institute, Walter was the chairman and CEO of CNN and the editor of Time magazine. He is also, and I don't know how he gets to do this, he is also the author of three major, major books, Einstein, His Life and Universe, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life, and Kissinger, A Biography, each of which I think is 500 pages minimum, 600.
I didn't have time to write short books.
The last, Kissinger Alive, was a finalist for the New York Book Critics Circle Award. Additionally, he co-wrote The Wise Men, Six Friends in the World That They Made. Throughout his career, Walter Isaacson has been a keen observer of the issues of our day and a powerful advocate of how to resolve them. Ladies and gentlemen, I can't leave you in better hands than these two wise, wonderful, generous people. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Dr. LeClaire. In fact, that was such a wonderful introduction. I can't wait to hear what we have to say.
Neither can I.
I don't know how we're going to live up to it. I do want to add a couple of words to the introduction, if I may, Dr. LeClaire. First of all, when you talk about the first library, we also should mention the first great library in America, the first circulating library, was Benjamin Franklin, who, the same time he founded it, founded the Academy for the Education of Youth in Philadelphia, which Dr. Roden became president of when it changed its name to the University of Pennsylvania. Secondly, I'd like to say about Dr. Roden that I come from New Orleans, and after the hurricane, we couldn't get anything done. Political leadership had failed. Everything was in paralysis. And we went to Judith Rogan and the Rockefeller Foundation because of what she had done at Penn in doing planning for urban universities, but also because she was one of the oldest foundations, but the most flexible, the one that knew how to act. And they stepped right in and they did the planning process. They got it going in New Orleans and calmed down all the political disputes between the mayor, the governor, and the White House by stepping in. And so first of all, I want to say thank you. And secondly, I want to say, what did you learn from that experience about what foundations can do when government is sort of paralyzed?
Well, Walter, I want to thank you because you were the vice chair of the Louisiana Recovery Authority and went back to your home state and hometown and really helped them to dig themselves out of this, both literally and figuratively. Walter came to us with this, and a real opportunity, I think, and I considered an opportunity. It was about 6 months after the hurricane. Everyone had given emergency aid. There was tons of money pouring in. But the Louisiana Recovery Authority was not able to get the large chunk of federal aid, about $187 million, that had been authorized, but they were unable to get it appropriated until there was a plan for recovery for the entire state of Louisiana. And it had bogged down so badly, and the political folks and the civic folks were warring. And I think that was well known from the media accounts, and I'm sure it felt much worse on the ground. We really felt that we had tremendous experience with planning. Rockefeller had in the 70s and 80s, really been deeply involved in funding grantees that were leading the community development process. We helped found LISC, which is one of the earliest community development entities. And so we thought we understood two things. We understood the role of the community in the planning process, but we also understood the importance of expertise. And where they were getting it wrong was that the experts came in, they had a very top-down, expert-driven view, and the community had a very bottom-up view, and they were like this. And of course, the politicians were letting that happen and felt caught in between. So we learned, and this was very early in my presidency at Rockefeller, we learned that it was okay for a foundation to mess it up in politics, that we didn't have a particular horse in that race. We didn't have a particular politician, but we wanted a particular outcome. And that outcome was a consensus-building, expert-included plan that really would get New Orleans moving again, and would be very forward-looking, and would have the buy-in of the community and would have the willingness of both the federal government and local government, but also private investors who were going to be necessary for the recovery to occur. That was the first time that I really saw that you can intervene at all levels, and secondly, that you have a right as a philanthropy to ask about the leverage that you get from your philanthropic dollars. So we put a lot of other money into New Orleans and many other things, but our investment in the planning process was $3.5 million. That included a variety of activities, included the experts and all of the plan. The day that plan was delivered and accepted both by the recovery authority and then the federal government, $187 million mm-hmm. got released for New Orleans. I consider that leverage. So we learned early on that grant making is only one arrow in our quiver, and that if we think only about grants as the role of foundations or philanthropy, then we're missing a huge other realm, many, many elements that really do unleash potential in a very leveraged way.
The other dysfunctional city that I live in is Washington. And
you choose them, Walter.
I know. And it's astonishing to me that basically this huge stimulus package, most of it is still clogged up. None has been spent from the Education Department, for example. And on, for example, home foreclosures, they just couldn't get it done. You've stepped in to unclog things in government since then. Explain how that works.
$13 billion was put into the stimulus package to stem home foreclosure. And we learned only a few weeks ago, and then you saw, I think, the article in the New York Times that said that only 500,000
$13 billion?
$13 billion.
500,000.
$500,000
have been done. I just want to get them.
And so we spoke to the people at HUD, and we said, what's the bottleneck? You know, and the theme here, New Orleans too, where's the bottleneck? And can a philanthropy go in and really help to break the bottleneck? That's a kind of core meta theme for our work. The bottleneck was that the local governments didn't have the capacity to work with the homeowners to utilize not only the stimulus funds, but what the banks were also now ready and able to provide in some of this home foreclosure assistance, staving off home foreclosure assistance. And so we will make this week $1.5 million grant. It will run boot camps in 22 of the most vulnerable locales, those locales around the United States where the foreclosures are the highest potential. Train the necessary officials and start to get that $13 billion released. So another theme, look for bottlenecks that you can break. Don't be afraid to work with government. Government has real resources. And often in philanthropy you say, well, you know, the government may be the bad guy and we're the good guys, and so we don't want to work with government. And we have really found that government doing its role well unleashes an enormous amount of potential, and we should all be invested in enabling government to do what it should do, and sometimes that's that little bit of help. You know, I'm reminded in this room is where Warren Buffett and Bill Gates announced that they were combining forces with their resources. The CEO at the time, Patty Stonecipher, always likes to say, you know, this sounds like such a mega amount of money, and Gates is obviously the huge actor on the block. But as Patty says, all the money that Gates gives away annually does not match the state of California's annual K-12 budget. So when you think about that in proportion, you realize the importance, obviously, of the philanthropic sector, but the importance of making government spend its money well and enabling, where you can, innovation, creativity, movement on the part of that bureaucracy that calls itself government.
It's amazing, though, because the Gates Foundation has done more for global health that's actually worked. And in Washington, we can't even get a USAID director. I mean, for a year, there's been nobody running the place. How do you create public-private partnerships with government? Is that the new way to get things done, you think?
I do think that that is going to be one of the things in the 21st century. Walter mentioned that our dollars are flexible. And if you think about foundation money used well as kind of nimble capital, not only foundations, but philanthropy more broadly, because there's magnificent and munificent individual philanthropy. But philanthropic dollars are often pilot project money, as obviously, as well as wonderful construction money, but allowing the recipient organization to do something that it can't do alone from its operating budget. Mm-hmm. Government is really to fund the operations. It isn't good at innovating. It's got too much going on. It's got too much to maintain. And so how you get that kind of leverage. Having said that, I want to correct myself and tell you about another innovation that we're piloting, which we think may help government to be more innovative. We've been working on a field called impact investing, which is there's $500 billion, it is estimated, that comes in pension funds, in asset funds that are looking for double bottom line returns, so a financial return and a social return. And many of the current pension funds have mandates to have a certain portion. Their problem is that they can't really find or do the kind of due diligence that gets them to find these great projects on the ground. So we've been working to figure out how to what the intermediation, the missing middle is. One of the grantees that we're funding is a group called Social Finance in Great Britain. They are all former investment bankers from all of the cachet name global investment banks that we all know so well. And they are working on, they're doing a lot of things, including social bonds and whatever. But they're working on a project with the British government that, if they're successful, I think could revolutionize the way government thinks. They've picked six areas in which they and the government agree that there really is evidence-based pilot work that shows something works. And I'll give you the example in a minute. So the first issue that they're going to confront is juvenile reoffending. The data in Great Britain is awful, just as bad as in the United States, but the juvenile reoffenders often get rejailed within 2 weeks to a month. And if you think about the overcrowding in the jails and more seriously, the hardening of criminal behavior that we all worry occurs with re-incarceration, it would be very good to be able to stave that off. There's great pilot data in Great Britain about how you would do that. So social finance has, and it's much cheaper, obviously, will save the government a lot of money. So social finance is floating bonds where either you, the retail investor, or an investment bank wholesale will buy a coupon, like you would buy a corporate bond or some other, a municipal bond, and you get paid out at a certain level of reduction of the reoffending rate in the juveniles. Mm. And it'll be the British government that'll be paying it out because they've calculated that the savings to them of not having reoffending is so significantly higher than the cost of the payout. And they're talking now, I'm going to see the final work next week, about a 9% coupon. So you're really talking about a great bond spending government money, but the innovation came from this social finance kind of skunk works team to government and put it to them.
To push back for a moment, if it's a 9% return, cool, everybody loves it. But I understand why government should have a social bottom line. I understand why philanthropists and foundations should have a social bottom line. Why do we think corporations should try to have a social bottom line as well as a financial bottom line?
We think about this in four quadrants. If you think about social and financial and then intersect them, there's some work that's purely social bottom line, mm-hmm. and that's great. And there's some work that's purely financial bottom line, and that's great. But corporations have already gone to one mixed model, and that's corporate social responsibility, where they really are looking to use corporate dollars to do socially responsible things. This is actually filling out that fourth quadrant, which says that you actually couldn't, it's not just social responsibility, that it is okay to do good by doing well.
Who said that? Ben Franklin.
Benjamin Franklin.
First Poor Richard's Almanac, doing well by
that's
doing
how,
good.
That's how Walter and I met. I was president of Penn. We invited him to talk about his Franklin book.
If you ever write a book about Benjamin Franklin, you never lack for invitations to talk to
or
Penn alumni.
Or aphorisms. And so that fourth quadrant is really interesting. And, you know, we worried as the markets started going in the tank and the recession hit, that maybe it would compromise all this work. But actually, now a lot of people are thinking they can only get a single digit return on their financial investments, so the double bottom line investment looks even better in a
Heck,
single digit return.
In this room,
return.
Anybody get single digits
totally.
For a couple of years would be happy than the past couple of years. You're an old legacy foundation. How do you reinvent yourself for the 21st century? You've given a few examples. But it's sometimes hard to turn a big old ship around.
It is. Rockefeller, for those of you who don't know, will be celebrating its centennial in 2013. We are the second oldest. Carnegie is first large legacy foundation in the United States. And what's interesting about Rockefeller, though, from its start, it was America's first global foundation. And until the end of the Second World War, the Rockefeller Foundation was giving more foreign aid than the United States government. So it wasn't until the Marshall Plan and all of the Bretton Woods kind of institutions getting started, the World Bank and others, that the U.S. government really got in the role of global philanthropist, if you will. So given that we've always had a global history, given that John Dee and his advisors loved right from the beginning this notion of scientific philanthropy. You try to have high impact, you test, you assess, you see what's working, and if it's not working, you pivot and you kind of re-engineer it. It's true to our core that you keep reinventing yourself. And we've had many times during Rockefeller's history reinvention over its course of work. This is another period of reinvention because...
Give me a previous example that you think is comparable.
When there was a huge shift...
Reinvention, then, yeah.
Well, in the beginning, Rockefeller went to the field, set up programs, and did the work. So the eradication of hookworm. They moved all... Which led to the creation of the field of public health.
Correct.
They sent 1,000 workers, essentially, and tons of Rockefeller staff, and they set up field stations, and they had field offices, and they did all the work. Mm-hmm. The same thing was true in the beginning of the Green Revolution work, particularly in Mexico and increasingly in Bangladesh and India, too. As civil society organizations started to develop, and Rockefeller was instrumental in helping many of them develop, it pivoted and realized that it could be effective, doubly effective in some ways, by helping these intermediary organizations, NGOs, civil society more broadly, to develop their own capacity by making their grants to those organizations, and then those organizations were on the ground, and they were, and that was a great insight because the philanthropy stops at some point, the grant making stops, and the foundations move on, the individual philanthropists move on. But if you're building capacity really on the ground.
It's a form of leverage you were talking about, leverage over time.
It's a fantastic form of leverage and a really important one to recognize. Rockefeller created not only many of those organizations, we call them Ringos. Yeah. Rockefeller initiated NGOs.
Oh, cool.
And in fact, when we started our collaboration with Gates on the African Green Revolution and started that organization, AGRA, we now have Gringos.
Oh, dear.
So we started the program of fellowships. So Rocky Docs,
yeah.
You know, who were educated scientists and technologists who were educated in U.S. institutions and then went back and populated. We were the first institution to do that. We now feel in a new reinvention that we must build the capacity of universities and research institutions on the ground in the developing world. And in fact, the bit of the brain drain was actually due in part to how generous we've been in the United States giving fellowships for American institutions. So how you find that balance between wanting to share with others in the world the best of what we have here and being willing to pay for it, but at the same time continuing to build capacity on the ground, I think was phase two in terms of that reinvention.
Yeah, that's a good point, and you saw it at Penn where you were a driving force. Certainly Tulane has been a driving force in New Orleans, but I just came back from Beirut, and the best force for good there is the American University
Absolutely.
In Beirut. And so you're right, that's a great way to leverage and build long-term capacity. As you as you're talking about changing the Rockefeller Foundation, there are four or five, and I'll toss them out one at a time, changes that have happened in our society or whatever. And I would like you to tell me how that affects, in your flexible way, how you change because of it. One of them, the first will be the recession of last couple of years and the economic crisis. How did you all change because of that?
We were very fortunate because we had done a lot of our refiguring and reconfiguring ourselves. So in terms of our internal structural changes, fortunately, it was actually quite minimal.
Okay.
In terms of programmatic work, we've been focusing in one of our initiatives on the economic and social insecurity of American workers, and we had been seeing the same evidence that had been much written about, and that is the growing inequality in the United States between the very rich and the very poor. You could feel the air, even before the recession, starting to get sucked out of the middle class. And so you started to feel a lot of sliding back into the category of the working poor, people who really had started to move up the ladder. So we were doing a lot of work on retirement security, saving security, again, looking for innovation. One of our proudest moments was a month ago when President Obama announced five new retirement and saving security innovations that the government was going to adopt. And four of those five were Rockefeller grantees and pilot work that they had been doing with and for us for the last 4 or 5 years, the savings bonds, the mandatory 401k with the mandatory opt-out rather than opt-in, which was particularly important for young and poor workers, and a number of other innovations. So I think that work positioned us well. We have created, focused on New York City in particular, an emergency fund for this year. And we don't give charity typically, except through our own philanthropy as employees. But we've been very focused on making sure that where there really were
the
needs
here, yeah.
in New York, that we're
focusing
on.
Go back to you
that.
Said Obama, as I noticed, adopted these new financial programs that were built out of a lot of your work. The one of the other changes I was going to ask you about, how it affects your operations, and I don't mean this as a political or partisan question, but the change from a Bush administration to the Obama administration. Does that make you have to calibrate what you do.
On our domestic work, definitely. On our international work, not. As you know, the Bush administration was very forward-looking in terms of its development aid, particularly in health and agriculture
and AIDS,
a lot of the issues that we work on. But domestically, it's been a sea change, and so we have had the opportunity to see a lot of the work of our grantees really influencing government, both by these demonstration projects and also, without sounding partisan, because a lot of them have gone into government.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good revolving door from that perspective. And I think that's true. I think that many of the think tanks that the large foundations fund on both the right and the left and the center have been revolving doors for government. And I actually think that's a good part of our democracy, because people, when they're out of government, are thinking deeply, they're researching, they're advocating sometimes, and but they have a good perch and a good knowledge base to go back into government well prepared to be thoughtful about the issues of the day.
The third change I want to ask you about in our society and how it affected you is the information and communication and networking technology revolution.
A sidebar, when Rockefeller started, he was really facing industrialization. And the challenges that he focused on were really the consequences, both negative and positive, of the Industrial Revolution. 100 years later, we're facing globalization. And so as we repositioned ourselves, we said, we really need to be focused on the challenges and opportunities presented by globalization. And technology is, first and foremost among them. We have seen a revolution in how quickly information goes throughout the world, the kind of oppression that happened during the Cold War. You know, even in the most oppressive countries now, the underground capacity to get information is absolutely enormous. And so all of those technologies, you're seeing the explosion of mobile technology, particularly in Africa. Mm-hmm. East Africa has only gotten underwater cable recently. And so...
But they're leapfrogging it and almost
don't need it. And so the things that are going on using mobile technology, we are giving farmers in the most remote fields mm-hmm. throughout Africa, through text messaging on their cell phones, every 3 minutes market information for their crops. Every 5 minutes weather information so that they don't worry so much about planting and what they need to do. We're piloting in Rwanda and Ghana technology that would essentially put both of those countries completely on technology platforms for their healthcare delivery, something that we obviously can't do here. So, because
if they have electronic medical records in Rwanda before I can get them in my
own doctor.
They
absolutely will, I can assure you, and they will be open source, completely interoperable, where every language will speak. I don't mean every computer language will speak to every other computer language. And in a pilot, about 30% of the population may be carrying their health record on a chip in their mobile phone.
And this empowers women, too, more.
Tremendously. You know, when I didn't know this. I'm not an expert in development economics. And so one of the privileges of really leading the Rockefeller Foundation has been how much I've learned.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the women in the developing world are often the most, particularly in Africa, the most significant laborers. 80% of the farmers are women, and they are obviously the caretakers.
But they also did not have control of finance, and with cell technology, you can control finance.
Two things, Walter. I think cell technology and microfinance.
Right.
The earliest round of microfinance loans went largely to women in the developing world. And they found, it's not surprising, they found that they were amazingly good repayment risks. So they have much higher repayment rates than most of our local commercial banks do. Secondly, and Hillary talks about this all the time, that when you invest in women, when they have the technology, when they have the education, and when they have the micro resources, they invest in their families. And that isn't equally true when you invest in men in the developing world. And we all hope it becomes true, but a lot has to happen for that to take effect.
I may be going out of our realm of expertise, but do you worry that in the Muslim world that's going to be harder?
I think it is harder. I think that's why there's so much interest in the political and social work that we have to do in Afghanistan, as well as the military work.
The empowerment of women going backwards, not forwards, especially in Afghanistan.
It is absolutely going backwards. And certainly there are countries in the Arab world where the rights of women are not yet abrogated, but where women in those countries are deeply worried, and countries where it is the case that women really have no rights. Even in Africa, so in non-Muslim countries in Africa, very few of the women who work the land in agriculture have land rights, property rights. And one of the pieces of work that we're about to embark on is trying to effect a property rights revolution in Africa for men and women.
Wow, that would be big, yeah.
We won't get total development unless that happens.
Who's it, the famous...
Hernando de Soto's
great theory on that.
Exactly.
You mentioned Afghanistan. Are you doing anything in Afghanistan?
We are not at the present time.
I don't blame you. I don't know why we're as a country trying to...
It's very difficult. We don't have vast resources. We give about $200 million a year, and we try to work where we really are confident that what we know how to do well will have impact. We assess ourselves for impact. We hold ourselves accountable for it. That's not to say that we won't do some pilots in difficult places. We're about to assist the government of Vietnam and the agricultural stations in Vietnam to assist Liberia in redeveloping their agricultural economy. And so both are tough places, but we think that partnering, and in development speak, that's called a South-South partnership. And in a way, that's another new thing that not all the expertise and knowledge exists in the developed world and the OECD countries. And one of the things that philanthropy can do is broker the South-South partnering and connection and learning. It's another form of capacity building. It's a great way of creating networking among institutions, among NGOs, and we actually do a lot of that.
That's absolutely fascinating, because in Vietnam there's an enormous amount of agricultural expertise and on health, including dioxin and other issues. And
exactly. So we could have taken, you know, the University of Iowa and Cornell. Yeah. That's what we did 20 years ago. Yeah. But we said, let's do it this way.
Mm-hmm. Let me open it up, since there's so many people here who know more than at least I do about philanthropy and foundations. In fact, you can either go to the microphone, or if you're bold enough, just raise your hand and I'll repeat the question if you're not loud enough. Yes. Yes, ma'am. Question is about birth control in the third world being controversial. And Rockefeller
had a very active reproductive health program in the 1980s, and that program was terminated at the time, having made marginal impact in the places in which it was working. The foundation most involved at the present time is the Packard Foundation, and they are heroic in having worked over the last 10 or 15 years, the last 10 years in particular, throughout the world, including the Muslim world, on reproductive health. The Ford Foundation does some work in this area, but Packard is the largest funder of American foundations. And as we all start to think about what a total, both gender-lensed as well as global health lens program will be, I think many of us will be coming back to think about those issues.
The Aspen Philanthropy Strategy Group, which started this past summer, and Judith was both a star and a driving force. I say this because you mentioned Packard. You talked about the need for foundations not to just totally replicate what everybody does, but to allow certain to take certain leads, to coordinate, to, if Packard is best at this, you know. So how do you see that working in an age of constrained resources?
Thanks, Walter. That's really critical to say, because I think 20 years ago, what a foundation president did when they were trying to get some work done was they would call all the heads of their other fellow foundations and they said, you know, if you're in for a million, they're in for a million, and so-and-so's in for a million, and they'd get it funded. When I came to Rockefeller, I looked at our prior 10 years of where we had done that kind of partnering, and of course then we asked them at the same time, and so if you netted it out, we could have just spent the same money on our own strategic priorities and had our partners spend their money on their strategic priorities and potentially been more effective. So we do partner, but we're trying to partner now, and now I'll just speak for Rockefeller, where it's a strategic partnership, not just a financial partnership, and to increasingly say, we want to partner with a broad sector, including government and private philanthropy and corporations, and that's one kind of approach. But the second kind of approach is paint the system writ large and imagine that another kind of partnering is a leveraged partnership,
right,
where you say, all right, these are all the levers that need to be pulled in order for change to occur. Government's best at that, so you guys do that. Our foundation's best at that, so we'll do this. You, corporation, you know, you're better at distribution channels, so you do that. We're going to continue to partner so that we've really built a robust network, and we're coordinating so that we're leveraging. But that way, we may be able to tip these problems over into really transformational change. Look, we've all been working for years, and a lot has happened, but a lot hasn't happened. And so we've got to change our mindset for new ways of working, not only new problems to work on, if we're going to solve some of these more pressing, more seemingly intractable issues.
You know, you would, one of the things when it's you and Vartan and three other people getting on the phone and each saying, okay, we'll throw in a million if you will, you might lose the accountability. There's no one foundation saying, how do we measure success? What are the metrics? How do you feel about serious accountability and metrics in what you do and taking responsibility for saying, here's the mission, we're going to measure to see what works?
There's a lot of work going on right now in metrics. We, with others, are funding a project whose acronym is IRIS, and what it's trying to do is build a metrics platform that would become a public good that everybody could use, that would have agreed upon standards for what a social outcome should look like. So that would be the minimum kind of metric. For the impact investing work, we then want to create a public 501c3 that's a rating agency, so can use those metrics to really say, okay, these are the better places, the better entrepreneurs, the higher impact projects to invest your money in. So that's one kind of thing. The second thing is we're all deeply committed to sharing our failures, to really measuring and to sharing our failures as well as our successes. We all tout our successes, but we're pretty quiet about our failures. Well, we should think of ourselves like a venture capital firm. Mm-hmm. We are venture capital, and so we should celebrate the failures in a way, because we're not going to have failures if we don't take risk. We want to take risk, but then we want to measure so that we know what worked and what didn't and why it didn't work. So a lot of us are very committed to that. That is very slow to coming to philanthropy. I mean, when I took this job, you know, people said there's no bottom line, yeah. philanthropy's slow to change, there's no accountability, and the like. And I think there are many of us leading large philanthropies now who feel that's a bad answer, mm-hmm. and really want to change that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am, in the aisle right there, standing up, yes.
This is to follow on that discussion. How do you balance the need to measure and ensure that your money is being well used with room for innovation, which inevitably allows for failure?
That's something else you talked about,
right.
The Aspen.
We actually have an innovation initiative. So we think innovation is a process as well as a product. And a lot of the work we're doing now is to try to test innovation models that have been developed in the for-profit sector, like crowdsourcing and user-driven innovation and design thinking, and bring them to development and social and environmental problems, and see whether they have the same power that they seem to have had in really moving the dial for more innovation in some of the private sector companies. Apple invented the mouse with IDEO through a design thinking process. We're now funding IDEO, which is a for-profit company, to do the same thing with some of the not-for-profit grantees that we have. Innocentive is a for-profit platform. It links 180 scientists and technologists around the world. And often businesses have a piece of a science problem, a research problem, that they haven't been able to solve, and that would unleash new innovation internally, and they haven't been able to get it through their internal R&D process. And so Innocentive developed a platform, registered all of these solvers, and they compete for prize money to solve that piece of the problem, and they've had amazing success. So we got Innocentive to work with us for the last 2 years, and we're registering development problems that have a science-based piece, and getting solvers, and we're putting up the prize money, getting solvers to compete. And in a minute, I'll give you one example, because they've just developed a solar anti-malaria device that will be cheaper than bed nets, which has been really amazing. But I'll come back to that in a minute. But what we have found doing all this work is that innovation processes are risky. And so not every Innocentive challenge worked. Not every design process worked with an NGO. IDEO came back sometimes ready to tear their hair out. And we are sharing all the learning because, we want to celebrate innovation processes rather than just the successful outcomes of innovations, you know, because otherwise it's too daunting. We all think, you know, I'm not smart enough, I'm not right brain enough, you know, how can I really be innovative? Well, it's a learning process, and there are ways to really learn how to maximize innovation. The malarial device. It's a cone-shaped paraffin wax, and paraffin absorbs solar rays during the day. So the villager puts it out in the sun, and it's able to absorb solar rays, they found, that was part of the solution, without batteries or photovoltaic cells. When it comes back in at night, it releases heat at about the same level as the human body heat at night. The villager wears a band during the day to collect his or her sweat, and the sweat goes around the paraffin wax, the band goes around the paraffin wax at night, and it releases the scent of human sweat. And so now you have the heat and the scent of human sweat attracting the mosquitoes before they ever get near the body. And it does a whole room. And the solver, the person who posted it was in Houston, The salver was in Australia with help from a person in China. You know, they've never met one another. They probably never will. But they have now collaborated in this new form of technology-based collaboration.
It's a wiki innovation.
Absolutely. Wiki, with all of these technologies, is really here to stay, not in the, you know, creation of encyclopedias, although that's one of the innovations, but learning in that way has changed. We're funding collaborative competitions, which are all done online. People are, like the Global Water Challenge, 22 organizations got together and posted a $1 million Global Water Challenge, and Ashoka is running this. And the idea of a collaborative competition is that when people post their solutions or teams post their solutions, two things happen. One, you get to see the white space, that is, where's the space where nobody's working, and maybe that's where innovation can happen. And secondly, you're incented to post early, because the earlier you post, the more other people can add to or question or whatever, and they collaborate on a final solution. So the Global Water Challenge was won by 16 either individuals or teams from 13 different countries who have never met but collaborated in that way to win $1 million to solve this solution about water in the developing world. You know, who would have thought?
This is how the information revolution changes philanthropy.
Yeah.
Edward, were you about to ask a question?
Yes. Well, first, you're in the people's palace. You know that. And we all appreciate the conservators around us tonight are helping to fund the people's palace. And we have a great leader in Paula Clare helping us do that. But as individuals, if I were lucky enough to sit on one side of Judith and you were on the other side, Walter, and obviously we want to support the library, and we do, and we asked you on individual philanthropy and how you would get involved and how you would solve the problem if all of a sudden you were in a position to do more than you were ever expecting to do, how would you respond to your dinner partner?
I do want to say, and I'm remiss in not saying, that Rockefeller has been one of the stalwarts of funding great institutions. So it was the lead funder for Lincoln Center 50 years ago. It obviously gave the land and was the lead funder for the Museum of Modern Art, for the UN. And so we're a foundation that believes in our DNA, in the importance of supporting the physical infrastructure as well as the intellectual infrastructure of great institutions, which really are the bedrock of our culture and our democracy. And the New York Public Library is one such institution. I had the opportunity to press Paul into service to lead a review for us of the Rockefeller Archive Center, so he got to know everything Rockefeller during that time, the family, the university, Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Rockefeller Foundation, and so he knows so well and firsthand what we have done and what we aspire to do. As individual philanthropists, I think the kind of work we do, we have a lot of internal infrastructure to do. We have program officers and feet on the ground and relatively big staffs to do that work really well. I would love to see more Warren Buffetts. That is, people who really say, I'm going to take a foundation, my money, and Warren is deeply involved. Actually, it's so seductive. I don't think he felt he would be deeply involved. I really think he felt he was going to give it to Bill and Melinda, he trusts them. And now he's deeply engaged on a daily basis. But it was smart to say that infrastructure is built and building. Those program officers are experts. Don't I get more personal leverage, to go back to the leverage question, as an individual philanthropist by using their capacity to bring me great ideas if, in fact, I want to invest in areas where they're working. So rather than me go out and try to figure out, you know, what to do in global health or what to do in agriculture or whatever, education, there really are extraordinary existing foundations, both large and small, that have very core expertise. And sometimes I wish the individual philanthropists, instead of researching the outcome organization, would research the foundation doing it, because they might get more leverage for their dollar. Mm-hmm. Or not instead of, but in addition to. I don't think it's either or. In addition to is a better way of saying it.
Yes, sir. Right on the aisle there.
Hope that will change the dynamic of what Rockefeller.
At the very beginning of the foundation, there was more upheaval in those first 10 years than in any period, including now, in Rockefeller's history, because Rockefeller himself insisted on continuing to learn and continuing to reinvent. And so what I wanted to institute, and I did this at Penn also, was say this kind of self-analysis should be normative. It's not that anything's wrong. We're not saying there's a problem. What we're saying is if we are a learning institution, which we call ourselves either at a university or at the Rockefeller Foundation, we need to keep learning about what we're doing and change what we're not doing well, enhance what we are doing well, but also keep learning. The world is changing exponentially more quickly than it did in any other period in our 100 years. And if we're not out there learning, feeling, and changing in response to some of these trends, we won't be doing the work that certainly John Dee Sr. expected of us. And I don't think we'll be serving our beneficiaries as effectively as we could. So we're going to keep reinventing ourselves. And I think by now my colleagues internally at Rockefeller sort of get it. They, you know, I stand up and I say things like that and they don't all run for the door. It is a much more dynamic. It's a little more threatening. But it's very exciting to be in a place that's asking itself, are we doing this well? Are we doing it effectively? What are we learning? We don't have to do, we talked about impact and evaluation. We don't only have to do evaluation at the end, because our kind of philanthropy is not like running a controlled clinical trial where we don't break the code and know who the placebo group is mm-hmm. until it's over. So what we've built inside is a robust learning and monitoring function so that we really do learn as we go from the work. And our grantees are our partners. So we're trying to build a culture with them so that our learning and their learning is shared learning rather than, again, threatening, oh my God, if I don't tell them what they expect to hear, I'm going to lose the grant next year. So we've got to be able to reward failure out there too if there's learning, if it's failure for a reason rather than failure for sloth or whatever. We're learning together. So yeah, we're gonna keep changing and we're gonna keep refreshing. I met with a great group today that's going to lead us and bring in lots of outside, very divergent thinkers in some scenario exercises. You know, we're thinking about what we know and how to do what we know better, but we're not thinking about what we don't know. Mm-hmm. And so now we're going to do some of these scenario exercises so that we can start thinking about what we don't know.
What a wonderful place to end. This has been absolutely fascinating to me. I truly thank you, and I'm sure everybody else agrees. This is a great
thank
evening.
You. Thank you, Walter, for being such a great partner.
A small plug, for reasons that you all will find obvious, The Aspen Institute is giving our annual award on our November 8th dinner to Judith Rodin. So y'all are welcome to come, but I'm not, you know, if you want to come, call my office. But she is a great honoree. Dr. LeClaire, I see you hiding. Oh, where are you? There you are hiding.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you want to, were you, okay. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you all very much. You're a great audience.